Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We are at the beginning of an infrastructure shift on par with the Industrial Revolution. As the effects of climate change become ever more real and the time frames become ever shorter, we must ask ourselves, are we capable of changing how we live and leave a mark on this planet in a way that is actually meaningful? That question has led me here. I'm in Dover, in the southeast of England, to meet the people and organisations trying to bring sustainable solutions to one of the world's most important sectors, shipping. 33% of the UK's trade with the EU come through this one port. Last year, over 6.5 million passengers travelled on this route. In this episode, we look at the shipping industry as a case study to see just how much has to be taken into consideration on so many levels in order to work towards a carbon-neutral future. What are the enormous challenges currently being faced, and what goes into building the ship of the future?
All engine running. Absolute genius.
Get this.
Welcome.
This is the show where we bring you
science.
What that essentially means is
discoveries,
advances,
questions,
research,
technology.
Unbelievable.
Without further ado,
this is The Naked Scientists.
Now, if you're a human being on planet Earth, the chances are you rely on shipping to uphold your day-to-day life. Some estimates put the amount of commerce transported worldwide by ships as high as 90%. That's food, medicine, cars, pretty much anything you can think of. But all of that comes at a carbon cost. To find out more, I'm jumping aboard a very special vessel to speak to a couple of people who can outline the scale of shipping's carbon footprint. Risk and sustainability expert Lisa Lewis and PowerCon's Peter Selway.
So the shipping industry globally produces about 3% of greenhouse gases, but it's responsible for transporting 90% of the world's commerce, so it's extraordinarily critical to the world's economy.
If shipping were a country, it would be the sixth largest emitter in the world.
To jump on that point and to make sure that we're all on the same boat, as it were, it would be so much higher if we weren't using boats to transport stuff around.
Yes, so shipping's an extraordinarily efficient way of transporting moving goods and people. On a short sea route, such as Dover-Calais, a ship like this would emit about 16 grams of CO2 per kilometre, whereas road transport would use about 62 grams of CO2 per tonne kilometre. So it's much more efficient, and on longer routes, it becomes even more efficient still.
If we remember that shipping is 3% of global emissions, road equates to approximately 15%. Aviation is only 2.5% of global emissions, but the efficiency of using jet fuel is far less efficient than a ship engine.
Given that this is still the best way of transporting all the world's goods, it is still kind of the plan to reduce the amount of CO2 being produced. Is there a set amount for a set date?
The UK government has committed to decarbonising shipping by 2050. To be on track to hit that target, we need to reduce emissions by 15% between 2022 and 2030. And at the moment, unfortunately, we're not on track to do that.
This is all talking about carbon dioxide. Is that the only greenhouse gas or harmful substance that is in play when we're talking about trying to reduce the footprint of shipping?
No, absolutely not. Combustion isn't 100% efficient. At its peak, it's approximately 65% efficient for the main engines, and compare that to a petrol car, which is 35% efficient. And when it's not 100% efficient, you get waste products coming off. If you're burning fossil fuels, you're going to get nitrous oxides, sulfur oxides, black carbon particulates, fugitive emissions, unburnt fuel gets leaked. There are lots of things in that can damage the climate and human health.
Most ports are in town and city centres. And so these emissions that are coming out, and often when you see pictures of a ship, you might see some black carbon coming out of the chimney stack. What you can't see is the nitrous dioxide and sulfur dioxides. And the problem is with even the low sulfur fuel that's been used at the moment has still got 100 times the sulfur content of road diesel. And that pollution is generally being blown straight over these towns and city centres.
So this is almost a direct public health concern as well as a general climatic concern as well.
Absolutely. I think shipping, by its nature, is out in the ocean, and I think it's forgotten about. But although it's a really efficient way of transporting goods and people, there's still big problems, and they're big polluters. And particularly when that pollution is close to humans, the impact on human health is considerable.
The modern experience of using a ferry or a cruise ship is very much more like a bubble than actually exposure and experiencing the maritime world. People, you know, drive on in a car, they go in very comfortable lounges, they use the restaurant, they might wander out for a quick walk on the deck on the prom, but often not at all on a short crossing between Dover and Calais. Therefore, people are in some way disconnected, and it's more of a sanitised journey.
All of what you're saying to me right now makes this sound like a really multi-levelled, multifaceted problem to solve.
So decarbonisation as an aspiration has got so many problems that will potentially create friction on the journey towards that target state. We've got disconnection in public policy. Drivers towards human health and drivers towards decarbonisation are not necessarily always aligned. The technology, some of it's in proof of concept stage. There are multiple options on the table. For a ship designer, ship owner, ship operator, which way are you going to go? And depending on your investment, you could have a long time to get that payback in terms of performance change. And you could be many years down the road in your design or construction when the public policy changes. And then what will you do? And in terms of all the potential solutions around the alternative fuels, there are many complexities and constraints around that, which Peter can go into more detail with.
These ships are some of the biggest machines humans have ever created. So the amount of energy they use is also absolutely huge. And there's lots of alternative fuels I've been looking at. If you want to hit these 2050 decarbonisation targets, there's lots of fuels like hydrogen, methanol, ammonia. They've all got lots of disadvantages. There's none of them that's an obvious alternative, and none that producing anything like the quantities that are going to need to fuel vessels of this sort of scale. And so one of the most obvious alternative fuels is electricity. And there's two elements of electrification of vessels. When a ship comes into a port, instead of running its diesel engines, it plugs into the electrical supply from the grid from the country and uses that to supply electricity whilst at berth, what's called shore power. The other solution is, in addition to shore power, if we can provide enough electricity that batteries on board of ships, like the ship we're on at the moment, can store that energy and use that energy for propulsion. Fundamentally, what we're trying to do here is decarbonise shipping by 2050 at the absolute latest. Yes, there are lots of alternative fuels. Yes, there's lots of issues with those. But we can't let that prevent us making the right measures now to try and decarbonise. And one of the big challenges we have with the shipping industry is that a ship will last typically 30 years, whereas a car might last, 10 years? Ships now will be still in use in 2050. So we've got to decarbonise now. And the only consensus fuel is electricity, because that's all these ships are using electricity at the moment.
So electricity, for the moment, seems to be the front runner in decarbonising the shipping industry. And one of the solutions is real and here. In fact, I'm standing on it right now. The P&O Pioneer is the biggest hybrid ferry in the world, taking people, vehicles and freight between Dover and Calais. I'm going to meet the man who can give me an access all areas tour of it.
I'm Ross Barrett. I'm the Ship of the Future Director for P&O Ferries, responsible for the build of the two new Fusion-class ships that we have currently sailing between Dover and Calais.
First thing, and it was the thing that was sold to me by everyone who encouraged me to come on the ship, we have a glass of water in front of us and we're doing what I like to call the reverse Jurassic Park test. There is no movement on this cup of water, and that's amazing. How is this possible?
Well, we're actually using Azipod technology on this ship, coupled with the hybrid batteries and a much more efficient hull line, which actually streamlines the vessel itself. So what we actually see is no vibration from this vessel at all. So in your reverse Jurassic Park moment, that's the reason why the ship is so smooth and attuned to a little bit like wearing noise cancelling headphones.
Now, I've always known ships to have a front end and a back end and them to look different. We're on a weird looking ship and it's making me feel nervous. Why is this such a strange shape?
So this is actually a double-ended ferry. It's actually the world's largest hybrid double-ended ferry. So that actually negates us having to turn in port. Because we don't have a forward and a back end, it means we are a drive-on, drive-off service. And that then gives us a saving. That means we can leave slightly earlier, not turn, and then deliver customers by sailing slightly slower.
But it's not just about the hybrid engine as well. There's all kinds of stuff going on this ship to help reduce its carbon footprint and impact.
That's right. We've got a huge amount of technology actually fitted this vessel. We've got heat recovery systems. We've got power management systems that help us balance the loads. We've got a very intelligent lighting system that allows lights to be able to dim. We can be able to control all of the zones on the ship, so we can shut down areas and heat certain other areas. We can take heat through our recovery systems that actually regenerates back without having to use boilers and provide that heat back into customer spaces as well. But we've also got very clever glass on this ship as well. So we call it the smart glass, and what you can actually do is dim the glass, lighten the glass, depending on how much light we want actually into the vessel, how much heat we want actually reflect back out as well.
This combined with the fact that if I shut my eyes, I wouldn't believe I was on a boat right now. I'm fully intrigued, and I would love to go and have a look at the inner workings of this boat.
We've come down the decks to the engine level, starting off the tour in the diesel generator room. There's not much to say, which is probably a good thing given the noise. But this is the past. Let's go see the future.
My name is Dmitry. I'm a chief engineer of Pride of Pioneer. We are in a battery room now. That's one battery room of four. That's about 4 megawatt hours. And normally, we're using them in a hybrid mode. That means we depart from port on one generator only, and the rest power is supplied by the batteries. Approximately within 30-40 minutes, depends on the power demand, the battery depleted, and then we need to charge them. Second generator kicks in and charge the batteries at the same time. Arrival port, we're recharging the batteries to their 80%, that's a healthy state of charge, and we are ready for departure again. We can run purely on the batteries with zero emission if needed. They will not last long now, but we have a capacity to increase the batteries, actually double its quantity.
We've actually got capacity now in these rooms, so it's been designed to actually increase these up to 4 battery rooms from 8.8 to 13.2 megawatts right now without any infrastructure change.
I appreciate it. It's not the quietest in the world, but we are in, you know, the bowels of the ship. It's really not that loud at all.
No, and one of the key things that we're actually really proud of this vessel is just how quiet this ship is with the technology that's been employed actually across the vessel as well, from its hull lines to its azipods to the vibration. Everything associated with this ship just makes sure that we give not only the crew the best possible environment that they can work in, but the passengers as well.
We've come below the waterline, and now we're in what I think is a spaceship. To my left is the open sea, and to my right is the engine room, and in between is nothing. Why is that?
The void space is for safety reasons. It's a double skin hull. If there will be collision or integrity of water, so the ship will stay safe. It will fill up just a void space and no machinery will be affected.
So we're stood in the azipod room, and the way an azipod works is a little bit unlike a conventional ship. So on a conventional ship, you tend to have two propellers on the back end of the vessel called the stern. They tend to counter-rotate, which then provides you thrust moving you through the water. Now, an azipod actually works in the opposite direction, so it actually spins and drags you through the water in a pulling motion rather than in a thrusting pushing motion. Now, this vessel's actually equipped with 4 azipods, so in order to propel without the drag, we actually run 2 of the aft azipods at 70% and 2 of the forward azipods at 30%, which give us the efficiency of dragging the vessel through the water. So the nice thing about azipods is they actually rotate 360 degrees underwater. So if we want to move the ship completely sideways in one motion, we can actually put all the pods facing the direction that we want the vessel to move and actually shift the ship completely in a sideways motion known as crabbing.
That's great. I love that. Well, that was absolutely fascinating, and thank you to everyone for talking me through that. We're back up here with Ross. The question, therefore, though, I have to ask, the whole point of this, how much of an impact does all of this have on the CO2 emissions of this ship?
So the key saving for this vessel, it being a unique double-ended design, means that we don't actually have to turn in port. And when you turn a vessel in port in order to berth at both Dover or Calais, you actually burn about 7 minutes extra fuel on each of those movements. So in fuss, we're actually saving about 14 minutes of time. Now, that actually means we can sail slightly slower. So rather than a service speed of about 19.5 knots, we can actually sail at 17.6 knots, still hold the same schedule in terms of how we sail and delivering our customers and our service on time. But more than that, what it means is that we're actually starting to reduce our footprint from a fuel perspective. So this ship will actually burn about 4 tonnes of crossing compared to our previous vessels, which are about 6 a crossing. So you can actually see from that we're saving around about 40% in terms of the fuel that we're actually burning on this vessel. And that actually then helps towards our carbon footprint reduction. With a bigger vessel as well, we actually carry more freight, using less fuel and a lot less carbon emissions.
So this is proof of concept. It works. People want to use it. And in my opinion, it's just really cool. So where do we go from here? What does it take for a hybrid or even fully electric ship to become the norm? Well, like with every climate-oriented topic, now we come to the part of the show with more questions and challenges than answers. And probably the biggest challenge is, unsurprisingly, power. I'm going back in to chat with Lisa Lewis and Peter Selway again.
A vessel like this, a hybrid vessel, has got two elements to it. First of all, when it's in at berth, it can have a hotel load. So this is a load that needs to provide electricity for lights, for ventilation, all the basic functions of the vessel. And in a ship like this, that's about 1.7 megawatts of power. Now, to give you an idea, a megawatt is about, if you think of a 5-watt LED light bulb, a megawatt would be 200,000 of those light bulbs. To recharge those 8 megawatts of batteries you got on board, you would need 20 megawatts. So that's equivalent to 4 million light bulbs of power. If you imagine the size of the cables, the sheer volume of power that you need to provide the power for the energy for this ship is just astronomical.
Two things leap to mind immediately. One, Dover is, and to an extent Calais, is kind of out of the way. You've got to get all of this power down maybe not the biggest grid in the world and then charge up these ships. And the other problem is you've got 45, 50 minutes to do it.
That's right. For decades, we had centralised power stations in the coal fields of Nottinghamshire. These massive coal power stations that generated vast amounts of power and distributed the power out around the country. The challenge with that was that the further you were away from those power stations, the smaller the connections became. It's like a human body and the veins. Ports, by the very nature, are on the outside of a country. And if you've got the infrastructure that's been built up around this infrastructure being largely in the middle of the country, it's a real challenge getting these huge amounts of power to these ports. But these things are changing, particularly with the advent of renewable energy sources. A lot of offshore wind farms coming online, and also local production, solar panels and energy production, means that the grid is becoming far more complex. And trying to manage this power demand is one of the biggest challenges we're going to face in decarbonising shipping.
In terms of the availability of energy, whether it's electricity or another fuel source such as hydrogen, nuclear, ammonia, there's increasingly a need to move away from a centralised system to a decentralised system and have it where it's needed, so local hubs. The problem with that is if you have on-site or offshore renewable generation such as wind turbines, most ports are in areas where there is protected wildlife, so there are prohibitions about putting up a wind turbine. If you're talking about on-site generation or storage even of something as toxic as ammonia, that will be a problem for the people that live and work in those ports.
And I guess the question itself of you have to generate all of this electricity as well, even if it's a nuclear power station or something like that. Quite a lot of the electricity we're currently generating is by burning fossil fuels. So there's also the idea that you might end up burning fossil fuels to get this electricity in the first place.
That's exactly right. In terms of the source of the electricity that's coming to the batteries or coming to the shore power, if it isn't green, it's just as bad as if we had a diesel engine running. So there are various policy instruments to encourage people to move away from that. Things like the insistence on using shore power at European ports, that's coming in by 2030. Again, within the EU and also coming to the UK is the emission trading scheme to encourage people to think about the source of the energy and if it's from a green supply.
So there are lots of debates about if we're just using electricity to provide shore power or to provide energy for its batteries. Aren't we just changing the problem? Instead of the diesel engine that's on board the ship producing this electricity, aren't we just change it to a power station? But in actual fact, the UK grid operates around about 150 grams per kilowatt hour, whereas the engines on board a large vessel typically produces about 650 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour. So it is far more efficient to use grid electricity to provide this energy than trying to generate it with diesel engines. And also, as we're seeing, the UK grid is gradually being decarbonised. We're seeing more renewable energies coming online. So that figure, 150 grams per kilowatt hour, is only going to come down.
So those are the demands and some of the potential solutions. But we've spoken a lot about the ships so far and somewhat neglected the other element of the route, the ports. The Port of Dover isn't owned by the government. It's owned by the Dover Harbour Board and is therefore independent. So whilst £144 billion of commerce comes through here every year, the annual turnover is less than £60 million. This means every decision about infrastructure change, particularly on a scale like this, has to be meticulously researched. So with all of these caveats around electricity, what considerations are the Port of Dover making throughout all of this transitionary period? It's time to talk to Port of Dover's Megan Turner about their plans going forward.
So the P&O Pioneer is just one of a set of two sister vessels. So her sister vessel, which is just the same vessel, again, will be coming to the Dover-Calais route in kind of January, February time and going into service shortly after that. So we'll then have the two hybrids. But long term after that, all three of our ferry operators have actually stated their plans to either hybridise or go fully electric, with one of the ferry operators looking to be fully electric by 2030. So that'll be five fully electric ferries on the route.
The elephant in the room really is, though, the question of how you power stuff, because as terrible for the environment that fossil fuels are, they are a decentralized and very quick and easy way of powering stuff. And an electric boat, you kind of need to power at each end or power at what end, and that surely puts a great amount of strain on the grid wherever you have to charge up, even if it's just one.
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of the work that we've kind of done collectively as a corridor so far has been looking at that electrical demand and what that's going to look like. On current technology, the vessels do have to charge at both ends just because of the current technology of batteries means they can't do a whole round trip. So we've done a lot of work of what that's going to look like, what is the size of that challenge. And we think it's about 20 times more the electricity than we currently have into the port. So into the Eastern Docks, which is this ferry terminal, we have about 4 megawatts currently that comes to the port. And we look to need possibly around 160 if all 13 vessels were to fully electrify. So that's a huge step up from where we are currently. So a lot of work has been focused on how do we do that, because as well, it's not as simple as just taking it from the grid, because the UK grid isn't fully decarbonised. So we would like to look at a fully decarbonised solution as well. So is there other options? So a lot of work has been done on that and all the different options, of which there are quite a few, because it could be looking to the grid or renewable options. But the infrastructure required to support that, as I'm sure you can imagine, is huge. And it's the same in France as well. They will need a similar amount of electricity that they don't currently have.
How do you think the best way of getting this electricity to the port would be?
So we're currently looking at a few options, being the grid or some sort of private wire maybe to a renewable solution. There's lots of different options out there. We haven't made a firm decision on which route yet, mainly because they're still at the start of this work. So what's going to work out best from a carbon perspective, but also from a cost perspective. We don't want the route to become so expensive that customers have to foot the bill. We need to make sure that this is done in a way that is still going to be cost effective. So things like renewable solutions rather than the grid normally have a cheaper cost throughout the life of that vessel, but a more expensive at the beginning. So it's kind of looking at all of those costs and figuring out which is going to be the best solution. We know that either way, whichever route we go down, we've still got to get that huge amount of electricity to the door of either ports. And then once you get it through the door, we've got to get it through a port. And that's the same for Calais. So it's quite a significant task that we've got on our hands here. And a lot of infrastructure will be required. We'll basically need an entire new grid system in the port and down to Dover.
This is, as you say, a huge undertaking and so many moving parts to consider. What's the kind of timeline on this sort of thing?
I mean, yeah, 2030 is not really that far away in the grand scheme of what we're talking about here. But I mean, as I mentioned, DFDS's ambition is fully electric by 2030. So that is a date that we're working to at the minute, to have at least five fully electrics plus the two hybrids we already have. I think it's fair to say that both the Dover and Calais for the P&O hybrids would like to give it to them much sooner than 2030. And that's definitely what we're working to. What's the quickest timescale on which we can do this? But even for small upgrades, because of the distance they're going to have to come, it is still looking like it's going to creep close to 2030. And it does look achievable at the minute with a lot of work going in right now. But the Dover-Calais route is responsible for 8% of UK maritime emissions. So for one small route, that's quite a considerable amount of emissions. Even if we can have those 5 fully electrics and the 2 hybrids by 2030, that's going to reduce the emissions of Dover-Calais, but also just UK maritime emissions.
I suppose we have to talk about the uncomfortable question, which is funding. How is this going to be funded?
So far, a lot of the work we've done on this has been feasibility studies, and we've been really fortunate that they've been funded through the Department for Transport and Innovate UK through the Clean Maritime Demonstration Competition. Funding to actually install them, obviously that's not something that comes from UK government. Interestingly, there's not a single shore power installation in the world that hasn't had government funding of some sort. So that kind of puts in perspective that we're talking about a really big expense, especially for lots of the ports in the UK are trust ports, which we are, which adds another little complexity onto this from a legal perspective. So part of the reason we haven't made a decision yet is, how do we pay for this as the port? Do we have to work with our ferry operators to pay for this together? Can we look for more funding opportunities? How can we fund it? It's probably one of our biggest questions at the minute. We know there's a little bit more feasibility work we need to do before we're quite ready to actually start installing things, mainly around the plug, as such, is the best way to call it. So there's lots of shore power systems that exist across the world. 30 megawatts per ferry is our best estimate at the minute. Amount into that ferry in 45 minutes is so considerable. What that plug's going to look like is part of the question we still have. How do we find a plug that all three ports can agree on, and all three operators, because we can't afford to have a separate plug on each berth for each operator? That's just too expensive. So that's a piece of work we know we need to do next, is looking at this plug. How do we find a plug that everybody can use, that works for everybody, that can actually do what we physically need to do? Because there's not many on the market right now that currently do that. So that's kind of what we've put a bid in under CMDC4, so the Clean Maritime Demonstration Competition, the fourth round, to see if we could start to look at designing that plug. Because once we've fixed that piece of the puzzle, we know everything we need to do then in theory. It's just a case of starting to install it.
So everything from power to policy to even plugs has to be taken into consideration. It's a daunting task, and honestly made more daunting the more I spoke to people here about it. But throughout all this, the mood from everyone involved is still one of optimism.
I'm really optimistic. I mean, we're in a really fortunate position where the key players that need to be involved are all really engaged in this. You know, we've got 3 operators that have been involved in those feasibility studies. We've got 3 ports that have been as well. All the people that need to be involved are really keen and actually want to do something about this. And that's quite a lot of the way there already, to be honest with you. Having everybody that sees that this is a necessity, we absolutely have to decarbonise this route. There's no other option, to be honest with you, and we all see it that way. So we're really optimistic. We've got a lot of the feasibility work done now. We've just got that little bit left to go. And there's definitely going to be a way that we can make this work, because we have to.
Yeah, completely optimistic that we're going to achieve it. This is an industry that's full of really bright and creative people that really care about climate change. There's also a range of policy and market-based instruments that are driving that change. One is statutory disclosure. When you want to borrow money from investors, banks or venture capitalists or anything like that, they will often ask you questions about what kind of risk you present. Think if you went for a mortgage on a house or a loan for a new car or something. Now, if that organisation is producing a shed load of carbon and isn't doing anything about it, then those investors would very probably think twice about lending that money. They don't want to get stuck with a stranded asset. They don't want to have someone that's going to default on their loans. So there's a lot of requirements in the UK and internationally about declaring how much carbon you generate and what you're doing about it to reduce it, and what your other environmental performance is like. With us in maritime, we have the International Maritime Organization, which is part of the UN. We have the EU, and we also have UK regimes. And there are a lot of different things pushing people to do the right thing. But fundamentally, people are good, and fundamentally, people do not want the climate to change or worsen in any way going forward. So on that basis, my faith is in the people to resolve the problems.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have now arrived in the port of Dover. On behalf of the captain, the officers and the crew, we would like to thank you for travelling with P&O Ferries and wish you a safe onward journey.
And that's where the story ends. For the moment. But I now share much of the optimism of the people on board, knowing now that those at the forefront of shipping decarbonisation have their heads and hearts in the right place. This is what the climate fight really looks like, in places where change can make a real difference. Thank you to Lisa, Peter, Ross, Dimitri and Megan for their insight, and thanks to you for listening. The Naked Scientist comes to you from the University of Cambridge's Institute of Continuing Education. It's supported by Rolls-Royce. I'm Will Tingle. Thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.